You're listening to a case study on how Health First Health Plans capitalizes on their risk adjustment department's value proposition, presented by Michelle Peek and Rachel Burns of Health First Health Plans. This session was presented in February 2017 at the Risk Adjustment Value Visit.
So I was going to cue this up by saying that we invite Health First back about once a year to give us an update on their efforts around risk adjustment. Health First has a really interesting program. I know they're going to cover it, so I'm not going to waste time in my intro providing details. But so I would just say that if the presentation today kind of leaves you interested in seeing more of, you know, how did they get to this point, because they've been building on it for years and years, we have, I think at least 3 years of case studies going back. And I know previous to my joining, they were doing case studies before then. So I'm sure there's pre-2014 case studies as well. So lots of recordings from Health First on risk adjustment if you're interested after today. So we have with us Michelle and Rachel, who are going to, was Laura originally? No, not Laura. Laura, okay, so these guys got pulled into it yesterday, right? It was one of those like, oh, we have a meeting, you guys get to do it. So another voluntold opportunity. So we really appreciate you two stepping up. And I understand you put your own spin on the presentation. So thank you again, and come on up.
So our presentation is going to differ from what's in your packet. I apologize. We're the data side of the team. They are more operations, so they like to give presentations. So we're probably going to get you out of here early. Our agenda, we're going to go over our internal program. We call ourselves Risk Adjustment. We report up through the COO now. We started under compliance, and every C-suite level we've reported through. Right now we're under operations. We'll go over goals and benchmarks, current structure. So we too included our current org chart, but we have a proposed org chart. We're working with our finance team and HR to get more associates, and I'll go into depth with that as well. Current processes, our future risk adjustment opportunities, and then open discussion if you guys have any questions. Our goals from our board and our C-suite level down, their goal is to increase risk scores regardless of EDPS, regardless of coding intensity factors. We need to maintain and increase risk scores. 2% was our goal placed on us yesterday. How we do that, we'll get into the details of that, our current practices, our best practices as well. We do a lot of benchmarking, a lot of dashboard reporting. I think I have 8 or 9 dashboards that go out every month to different functions within the organization. Our clinical documentation improvement program, that's a piloted program that we worked very closely with David Seal and the Florida hospital team. So we don't have final results, but we can share our practices, how the data was aggregated, how we performed that. Within pretty much 4 months, we had it from a concept to implemented and completed. Also, our supplemental chart review best practices, how we review it. We have a little bit of different policies for ACA and Medicare, but our team does own both all of the Edge server data submissions, which is Rachel and I. We own that process entirely, as well as Medicare. It all reports under one function of risk adjustment, but we do have a multidisciplinary team that we engage for consulting or to keep us honest, as well as how we integrate our data. We would love to get other people's ideas, how what they're using for baseline of risk adjustment data to manage their medical management program, how we can implement our data into HEDIS so there's less chart reviews on their end, because our departments are distinct at this point. They take our data in, but there's a lot of duplication of work, chart retrieval processes that we're really trying to hone in and get best practices at this point. So I think secondary goals, these are our future goals, as well as current implementations. We're trying to really get these squared down and really have great business plans for all these, our prospective reviews. We underwent an evaluation. Healthscapes completed that. She's not here. She must have left. And we actually had really great results. What I'm hearing consistently is our providers, we need better provider engagements. That was what we were found to be our area of opportunity. We excelled in our chart review and our comprehensive health assessment or our in-home assessment program. We were industry leaders in that, so we were very proud of that. We're working on a population health management tool with our decision support team as well as our hospitals. Like Laura presented yesterday, we are an IDN, so we have a medical group that sees about 60% of our entire population. We have access to those EMRs, so that really helps us do our job more effectively and efficiently. Our financial predictions and benchmarking, we work very closely with Julia at Wakely, as well as our actuary and finance team, both on the ACA and Medicare lines of business. And we also, we have the ability and the tools to accrue our mid-year and final reconciliation and monitor our risk scores with each submissions, and that is also reported out on our dashboards monthly. Staying on top of CMS changes, we really engage our entire team, which we'll go into the structure of that next. When you're hired, you have to read every single CMS manual, the risk adjustment technical guides. We do PowerPoint presentations to leadership within our team. We want them to be engaged not only from a coding platform, but also from an operational and CMS side so that they understand. We have everyone, we encourage everyone to read the call letter that was just sent out. We do a lot of roundtable discussions, weekly meetings where we include all CMS changes, and then we brainstorm and take back ideas and concepts that were introduced with the call letter, which is pretty flat from last year. And identifying care gap opportunities, risk adjustment, we always try to code what we can so that we can provide in a data extract to our HEDIS team. So every time we're in a member's chart, we're coding the BMI, we're finding the colorectal so that those data sets can at least be a guide to where the other teams need to go and look on which data service, because it didn't come through on a claim, that that data can be found. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point there, because we do the same thing. We've developed an internal tool when we're out data mining, and we've actually developed the screens in our tool for our coders to go ahead and populate that information. And then we pull it off into a file set, and we give it to our HEDIS folks, and you know, for like even for the five-star. And they said we have found enough to push them up in several categories where they were struggling to get to. So I think you do bring up an excellent point that everybody should think about how to combine the two.
Absolutely. Thank you. And we also have a vendor for our comprehensive health assessments, and they were able to close 80% of the gaps that were not done in the clinicians. Through every single chart review, it was never documented. So we, to be clear, open and honest, we were a 4.5-star plan, went to a 4, and then a 3.5. And when we implemented that program, we jumped back up to a 4-star plan. So we started integrating that model into our practices about 2 years ago. But our vendor was really able to do that lift once we identified and really work collaboratively interdepartmentally. And we also, on our homegrown comprehensive health assessment, we built a database that stores all the data and analytics. So if you want to query, we can run queries to identify anyone where those care gaps, and we'll actually ping the provider. We have access to the EMR. We'll go in the EMR and ping them back to ask for an amended chart or a response. Hey, we don't see a colorectal exam or a FOBT, or sigmoidoscopy based on the 1-5 and 10-year trend, or you haven't done a microalbumin on this diabetic patient. So we'll go back and ping those through that program. And then we're also partnering with our vendor, and they're doing that at site. So they're doing that in the comfort of their home, doing all those draws. So we've really seen a real huge increase and lift in our STARS and HEDIS measures by kind of being a little more involved and kind of minding their business, minding HEDIS's business. But it's collaboratively worked well. Additionally, a good thing to know is we save all of our medical records. We do not do chart review in a provider office because it helps multiple ways. For audits, we have a very intensive auditing team. We also again, to Lindsay, our counterpart, has said, we are selected for almost every RADV, and 90% of our records we already have in our data warehouse, so we can reference those. And then thirdly, we share those with HEDIS, medical management, appeals and grievances, finance and claims, if they're doing review. Sometimes just due to simple timing, we haven't got the request in or the request hasn't been made because of a claims lag, but we have a massive data warehouse with all of our records. Leading into that is you can see kind of our historical.
Yeah, real quick on that. For your data warehouse, how do you actually store the medical charts? Are you putting it into like a Mesas or another, or do you have your own homegrown system?
We do not. We have a vendor. Versend is our vendor, and part of their data packet or part of their package, our business agreement, is what they call the medical record vault.
Okay.
So they store it for 10 years visible to us.
What was the name of that company?
It started as Health Risk Partners, and we have been with them since 97. Then they were Verisk about 5 years ago, and last year partnered with IBM, and now they are Versend, V-E-R-S-C-E-N-D. They offer that as part of the package where we also do our coding into. So that tool is used to code into. They map our supplemental for both RAFs and EDS to their original claim. We can work our orphans from there. There's a lot of opportunity. I don't want to plug any. I don't want to plug. That's just what we're doing.
I just wanted to see how you were doing that, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Michelle. So when you said in the tool, so is that how you access them or to save them? So if you get a RADV, or do you guys save them as PDFs in your own data warehouse, or how do you, what do you do with the records to store them?
For our EMR access, we don't export anything out unless we're being audited. And then we do have the privileges to export for a RADV. But for all of our non-employed physician or non-EMR access, we get everything via PDF. We download them and store them locally. And then we push them to Versend via FTP. And then once we've QA'd, made sure everything's gone, we do get a data or a file receipt. And then we delete those locally, but those are stored per HIPAA guidelines on their servers.
Are the records retrieved by the HEDIS team also stored in Versend's record management system?
Yes. They have the ability to also store them. Unfortunately, at this point, that they have not integrated their platforms. So they use the Risk Adjustment or Recon Edge platform to input and review in there. So they have view access as well as they can import as well, so we can integrate.
Michelle, do you collect all the sections of the medical records?
Yes. When we use partner, we do about 50% of our retrieval internally, but because of our service area, it just is not cost efficient to send analysts on a six-hour drive. We partner with a medical record retrieval company. So we actually do 100% chart review. Every single risk adjustment encounter is requested, regardless of we think this specialty is a little more fruitful or other, and that's directive from the top down. So that is our goal. But we actually do a blended model of our retrieval where we take the providers who will only work with us, or we have a relationship, or they use a secondary retrieval company, so we don't want to pay a retrieval company to pay another retrieval company, so we'll take that on ourselves.
It's an interesting idea because for the HEDIS, they have, well, for risk adjustment, we don't pull every single section of the medical record, and for HEDIS, there are other area targeted initially, but I think it's a good idea taking everything. But the problem at times, some of the medical records, we may be talking about hundreds of pages we have to scan. So that's exactly why we were trying to, because we get almost 100,000 charts also.
Yeah.
It's significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just what we're getting from our non-EMRs. So there are always times where charts are missing. It's easier to do an extract from an EMR. You're pretty much guaranteed it's in there. They're signing the charts timely. But when they're, and we actually have a lot of physicians who are very old school and have not transitioned, about 20% of those are handwriting notes still, which is a huge problem. So yes, we do PDF them, they store, and we do request for HEDIS. We're not really going back 10 years, A, because the physicians are not storing that physically, but we try to collect from every instance where the data collection period's open. And we'll get a little bit more into our flow, how we work that, so you can kind of understand where we're coming from a chart review side. Yes, ma'am?
Okay, yeah, I'm just hitting you with rapid-fire questions, and so appreciate it. You said you retrieve 100% records. Do you also do coding abstraction for all of those records?
Yes, every single encounter is coded.
Okay.
That we receive. Now, we don't receive everything. This year, we ended at about 92% of our requests.
Okay, I can understand the value add of being ready for RADVs, and especially if you get selected for it a lot, the value add of, then you can use it for HEDIS as well. But it seems to me that the return on investment will be drastically lessened because you have to expend so many resources getting those records, even though they may not have been identified by, say, predictive modeling that will have a financial return. How do you measure the ROI differences between shooting for 100% encounter retrieval versus limiting it only to those where you have reason to believe you'll have a suspect?
So, like previously stated, there's a lot of stuff that's missing through analytics. Our Florida Hospital Partnership is very new to us, so we're going blind at that. So we didn't have historical data. So 100% was the only way to go, so we had that baseline of what we can expect. Now, Health First Health Plans, that's the company that I work for. We have a little bit more historical data. So we were doing suspecting. We were high, medium, low, and no suspect opportunity. What we found is your data is only as good as the data that's on the claims. So we were finding as much opportunity with the low medical expenses, no prescriptions because they're going to Canada, or they're doing homeopathic treatments. We're finding those chronic conditions equally in the no identified risk as well as the moderate. Now, the high, year over year, we're finding that opportunity we're working on through a clinical documentation program because, like previously stated, they've been monitoring their CHF for 30 years and they forget to document it. So it's almost lost documentation and lost opportunity. Now we've lost their risk score. We're not able to substantiate their risk score from year over year. So we're only as good as really the data that's in and the documentation that's done.
So your claims-based suspect identification methods really aren't cutting it for you?
It's not cutting it. We do use historical risk adjustment data as well. And we also have a very green leadership. Our C-suite is pretty much all within 2 years new to us. So their requirement for us is 100%. No ifs, ands, or buts, 100%. We do not get bonuses. Our annual raises are based on that retrieval. If we do not meet a threshold, we do not get a raise.
And I think AvMed has the same approach. And I know you asked a question about return on investment. Well, we don't want to do 100% fully now because it's not scalable as we continue to grow. And we have historical data for many years. But even with 100%, we review about 100,000 records. Our return on investment is still 20-1. So far we're doing okay, except that we don't think that we can continue to do it as we grow. But we still have a great return on investment. And the way it's computed is the full cost for the department, salaries, software that we use against what we bring. And it's still 20-1.
I assume both of you have discontinued any suspect analytics, which saves costs and resources. I mean, a lot of people pay a vendor hundreds of thousands of dollars to do predictive analytics, and there's a savings there. And if you're still getting a 20-1 ROI, I think that's still a very powerful example of a 100% approach.
Yeah. We still do the suspect and analytics because tomorrow they could change their mind. So we always need a backup plan. So that is done, but it's homegrown. Rachel and I are managing that. We have the ability. We have the data. We can parse it. We can segment it. We can deliver it however whomever is asking needs it. So that's still being done, but we're also doing 100%. Because
it's already built in. It's
not correct. Yeah, it's built in, and we're using that data to find those year-over-year chronic conditions that have dropped and taking that data and doing that pilot program that we did last year with Florida Hospital and saying these are the diagnoses that still have not been captured. We've reviewed every chart. We don't see them. They haven't come on a claim. They haven't been documented compliantly. They may be in the PMH, but they're not compliant for risk adjustment. So we do take that data and apply it to other policy or other operational instances.
I just have a quick question. Do you happen to know just ballpark what your percentage is of EMR versus what you are retrieving?
Well, yeah, so we have about 60 to 64%. We have access to all of ours and Florida Hospital's inpatient records. We have our entire physician-owned EMR access. We have our own cancer center medical records, as well as the highest volume ophthalmologist office, which is about 5,000 of our members. We're a 36,000 member plan, so for Medicare alone. So that is about 60% of our charts requested. And we're working through an ACA agreement on getting the outpatient Florida Hospital physicians EMR.
Michelle, is this retrospective review? So after a claim has been submitted and paid,
yes.
not real time. This is all retrospective.
So it is and it's not. Our model is we always look back in a data collection period. So we do two chart reviews on every member every time. And the reason why we do that is because we're relying on the physician to send us the record. A lot of stuff is missed. We're relying on vendors to get everything. And then we're also relying on data, which has a 90-day claim lag. So some of the occurrences haven't occurred. So we do a lot of overwork. We do have reporting that can drive the coding analysts to not duplicate work. But we've also found that it's most consistent to code from the beginning of the data collection period. So right now we're coding January 1 of 16 to today, and we're in the EMRs. So if there's a visit happening yesterday, it's being coded. And that's how we practice all of our projects. So much that we do is from retrospective to the most current data service that is in that chart every time.
And have you followed this process before the RADVs, or is this because you guys continue to get selected for the RADVs? I mean, 100% is great. It's just a lot of us don't have resources or can
correct.
Do that. So we're very interested in.
So because of resources and the newness of the team, I joined the team in January of 2009, and the team was very, very infantile. There was one person who was doing chart review, found the low-hanging fruits from a diabetic suspect list, and found $5 million. I started in January of 2009. We were RADV'd later that year. We didn't have that model, but I will tell you in the CY11 RADV, we were able to eliminate our record retrieval by like 75% because of having that and doing a more complex chart review. And I know that payment year isn't in this model. I didn't go far enough back. But it was pretty consistent to 2012. Those four FTEs were dedicated to everything, though. Until 2014, those FTEs from 2013 beyond or prior were doing all the submissions, all the audits. We had a team of four that was doing everything. So now, from 2014 and beyond, those are just dedicated to coding. That is their only job, nothing else.
I have more questions, but let's see what the fourth slide says.
Okay.
Throw it out there.
So again, is that our fourth slide? Okay, it is. Our comprehensive health assessment, again, our executives would like 100% targeting. That is the in-home assessments where you have the one-time visit. It's done by a vendor. It's done by your homegrown program. We have both. It's pretty much 50-50 split with our membership. Our medical group is doing that. We're still struggling. They're not doing as well as our partner, but our our vendor partner, that's all they do. So we're in discussions on how we're going to maximize that. Do we want just a nurse practitioner model? Currently, our PCPs are doing the CHALS with a nurse practitioner model so that there's not much outreach. They're doing it during their annual wellness visit. They're capturing this, but it's almost become a fill the box. So they're heavily compensated for doing these. They get cash bonus, they get 6 RVUs, and they get the claims reimbursement. It's a lot to do. So they're fulfilling the need to complete the CHAW form we built in their EMR system, but they're not thinking outside the box and really documenting to the highest level of specificity. And we are seeing that being done with our vendor. So there's a lot of coding education that we're doing and working with that provider group. So that we've had that program since 2013, and we're just fine-tuning it now. It has great potential, so we really want to see that fly. Our clinical documentation, again, that's what we've partnered with Florida Hospital, and David Seal's team's really, he's the one, he had his team on the ground in those provider offices delivering contracts, getting those records, delivering that, doing the education. So we really thank him. We gave them a deadline of January 31st to get the records in. We received, we queried about 1,000 HCCs. We got 48 back. We got more contracts back than that, but 48 HCCs, that these are things that were not documented, that were clear, that were only identified through this program. The physicians acknowledged, yes, we have that back. This is stuff that would have gone missed. So with only having 3 to 4 months to really start, implement, and complete this project, 48 is better than nothing, and that's a pretty decent return for a piloted program. So our current structure, that was pretty popular. Currently, we report, again, through the COO. We report, Lindsay's our manager, and I report up through the Director of Government Programs. She reports up to the COO. Under Lindsay, she has a supervisor of operations. He is the one that leads all the productivity tracking, does kind of the HR stuff with our team. So that's where he sits, and we also have a quality team that sits under the manager of that department, where we have an internal auditor. So every 2 months, our team is audited. That is also, we have 3 points that we have to meet for our bonuses. Our coders are required to meet 98.5% compliance. That is done. We do 30% chart review, or 30% review of all revenue generating HCCs. So it brought a new value to the organization. That's audited, and feedback is provided to our analyst a few weeks after that audit is completed, which is about every 2 months. Sometimes if there's a special project, it may lag a few weeks behind, but we're pretty consistent with every 2 months. And then we have 2 analysts that are dedicated strictly to our CHAW program with our provider group, and that is a full-time job. Under our supervisor, we have 10 risk adjustment analysts. They are all bachelor's levels. They're all CPC required. You have 1 year to get that certification, as well as PAM. We require the highest level of certifications to remain compliant, and that's really kind of from our compliance officer down. We need them to have that certification so they understand the ramifications of coding. That's our preference, but everyone has different models. And then we have business analytics. So I'm the senior business analyst. Rachel's our business analyst, and we pretty much do the stuff that no one wants to do on the team, as well as data and analytics. So anything edge is me. I do all the submissions, the reconciliations, the getting our data to and from vendors, cleaning up all the MAO2 errors, the 999 errors back to our 837 vendor. We work through our claims vendor. They provide us the 837. So that is Rachel and I. As well as financial projections based on, I don't do projections, I'm not an actuary. I take data and I apply a financial return to it. We do that, all of our dashboard reporting, so that is our role. We are also certified coders. We started in that role, we understand risk adjustment, and we built ourselves up through that program. And I found that that was, it really gives you a competitive advantage to understand risk adjustment and the technical components of it. Is that me or you?
That's me.
Okay.
I mean, you can take it if you want. So Michelle's already kind of touched on a lot of these aspects, so hopefully all the questions are done because she took them all. But we currently review 100% of all risk adjustment acceptable records. We do that for various reasons, and we've found great benefit to that. Like she mentioned before, the charts or the dates of service filter through our platform twice. So what they're reviewing now for 2017, someone else or sometimes the same analyst will review again next year at this time. It's always good to get another set of eyes, just two different coding perspectives. We give our analysts... We give them guidelines, but we also want them to be analysts and use their best judgment. So we have more lenient coders and we have more conservative coders. So we want both of those analysts to look at it. We also do audits ongoing, like Michelle mentioned. We do our internal audits at the data service level and at the member level. So we, at the data service level, we want to make sure what is being submitted from our internal team is correct and accurate. But at the member level as well, from our internal team, we want to make sure we're not missing anything. So we look at our member, one member, every project they've been coded in, and see what did we miss. And then we bring that back to the team individually and as a group, as a tool for education. We also do retrospective audits on our provider group, our employed physicians. We look at claims once after the claims run out and after our team has had a chance to look at that full year of encounters. We compare what we captured to what they captured. So anything that a provider submitted on a claim less than three times that was revenue generating, but we did not validate internally, we go back, we take a team of a few people, and we audit. And we look, why did they submit this? Was this an error? Is this something we missed? And do we need to educate further on our team? Do we need to educate the providers or the billing staff in their office? Why was this coded one place and not the other, just so we can reconcile and keep those two in line. So some of our opportunities, and we've touched a little bit on this already again, but for prospective reviews, so our comprehensive health assessment, we want to increase member acceptance from 30% where it is now to 35%. We're doing that right now with a gift card incentive, so any Health First Medicare member that has a CHA done either internally with our medical group or through our vendor, they get a $50 gift card. They love that. It works very well. So we should see that, I think, pretty easily. We want better coordination with our quality and medical management department, HEDIS, and quality and risk adjustment. We do a lot of the same things, so I think it just makes sense to integrate those even further. Like Michelle said, our departments right now are pretty distinct. We use a lot of the same tools, but we don't necessarily use them in the most efficient way for both of us. So we want to kind of integrate those further, work together more, rather than doing the same things just in different ways. And we also want to just increase CHA engagement across the entire IDN. We want people to be excited about risk adjustment, excited about this program, understand the value of it. And with this, what we're doing, right now we've engaged our customer service department. They are actually able to now warm transfer either to our internal scheduling department. If they talk about a CHA with a member and they're on the phone, they say, hey, yeah, I'm really interested in that. They can warm transfer either to Matrix, who's our vendor for our CHA or external CHA program, if they want an in-home assessment, or they can do it with our employed physicians.
How do you track the gift card? So how do you track that they've had a CHA done?
So we get a report. It's twice monthly. We get a report from our IT department that gives us all of the CHA encounters. And our CHA team will go in and code and validate that, yes, a CHA was done. They have their tracking system, and Michelle, I think you know a little bit more about that, working with Sarah, but they have a tracking system, and we work with Plant Ops, I believe. We keep a tracking number. We keep the gift card number next to the encounter. So once it's mailed out, Plan Ops kind of takes the tracking from there. But we get the report. We import it into our access database for our CHA program. Then our CHA analysts will take that data and ensure that they get a gift card from there. That is then passed to Plan Ops, who they physically mail out the gift cards, and any issues from there we all kind of deal with together.
Do you use a specific code for your CHA to identify a specific EPT, CPT or HCPCS code?
Yeah.
That's only used for that?
Yes.
Okay.
We configured our system, which we use AmorSys, so that when this person bills this with this diagnosis combination, it pays that X dollars, both for the medical group as well. But we also use our vendor matrix as well as our health first medical group. We also use internal reporting. So we built a reporting report from both systems because our claims lag, we have to get these gift cards fast out faster than we're receiving those claims. So we have other processes in place that help. And then if there's any fallout, we do store that all in a database. So we just built queries so that if there's anything that fell out, so anything that's in claims that we didn't get in the report because all these policies and procedures were not followed, we can find the delta and identify those numbers that were missed through reporting.
Can you shield your mic on?
Oops.
Sorry.
Do you follow the every 12 months calendar year? How do you make sure that they're only doing it? You know, because basically this is an annual wellness visit.
No, it is and it's not. So we have actually a program that we can do the comprehensive health assessment and the annual wellness combined, or just the comprehensive health assessment, and then we have it with our medical group and matrix. So if they do the annual wellness, we tell our providers 366 days on the 366th day, but our configuration system's a little more lenient. Really, what we're trying to communicate to our providers is one time a year a CHA needs to be done. Try to align that with your annual wellness, but if they don't see you for that, still do a CHA, but we need it once a year, and we really want it in the beginning of the year. We really want it in January and June. That's our huge, that's when we want it. We're going to get the money fastest in that time frame. But we still, the program is an annual program, and we do it once per calendar year.
Do you have any problem with do not call? You know, when your vendor and the members said, you know, I don't want to be called by them anymore. Mm-hmm. And do you have a policy around? Because we have a big, we can't get to that 35% because we have a lot that people have gone into a do not call status.
Yes. So how we combat that is they're not called again, but we can market them through mailers. Mm-hmm. So we'll email them, or I'm sorry, we really, our email system, we really don't have a lot of address. We will send a marketing mailer just saying, hey, we would like to offer this program. We're giving you a $50 incentive gift card. Would you like to participate? Unfortunately, I just don't have the statistics. Our marketing team tracks that. We also have very specialized phone numbers that our marketing team has so that when an inbound call is made, they can track that as well. Unfortunately, I just don't have the results from the do not calls that have made an inbound and scheduled, but I could probably get that and post back with Kristen as a follow-up for that.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I love that idea there that you send out the letter afterwards because we also have a database of do not calls because there's a lot of people that think this is a scam type of thing and they really get upset about it. Mm-hmm. So we move them in there, but then we never did any follow-up. So I like your idea there. But then my other question was is, you know, we have a lot of the annual wellness visits done by physicians, but one of the things as we've been tracking this, we've noticed is we get a member and he's with a physician for 6 months and they do this visit. They then move over to a new provider and then they also do the same exact visit. You know, and per CMS, you're really only supposed to have one per member per year. So how do you guys work that or what did you put in place?
So we actually did put very strict parameters around that. We're only offering this to Health First Medical Group, which is our provider-owned group. This is managed by a team that we built called Care Coordination. So they are the center of the scheduling. And quite frankly, we deny the claim. The member is not billed if multiple is done. But the instances in 5 years are less than a handful where we have that. I think our challenge would be because we do not require our members to be assigned to a PCP? We don't even know. We have to do PCP attribution on the back end and analytics to say this is who we believe your PCP is. The challenge would be implementing this with a provider network that's we're non-employed, and we're not there yet because of the volatility in how often these members jump. And I'm talking like most of our members see at least with a specialty day 8 and 11, they probably have 2 to 3 different PCPs that they're seeing in a year. So you just, I don't think we're ready to combat that at this point.
Yeah, we're struggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Click forward, I think. So for our concurrent reviews, obviously our care gap programs, we want to implement, we want to streamline everything so it's all kind of in line, it makes more sense, it's less work for everybody if we can kind of work with, again, our quality and our HEDIS teams to get what they need, get what we need all in one shot. It's easier, better for everyone. We want to work with providers and their staff and getting claims data improvement, getting it clean from them. It's a lot easier for us. It's a lot less work for us. And with that, our billing and claim system needs some work, too. There are certain little quirks and little things that make it hard for the providers to give us what we're asking for. Certain things are built into the EMR system, and it doesn't, I believe the professional code, you can only submit 4 diagnoses with our EMR system.
In our EMR system, they're 5010 compliant, but they don't follow all the guidelines. They didn't upgrade their package, so 4 is the limitation.
So that is a struggle. Mm-hmm. So we can't, you know, we're asking them to give us a complete picture of the member's health, but how can you do that when you're limited to 4 diagnoses? So we're working through that, and similar with our claim system, there are certain things that get dropped, you know, or go missing and shouldn't make it from adjudication, and they do. And so we spent 3 months, I think, at least, cleaning up about 37,000 fatal and non-fatal claims errors last year, and that wasn't fun. So if we can kind of streamline that, clean that up, get it clean going out, and just fix the little things here and there that we have to, that would be ideal. So we definitely see some opportunity there to get that that process improved. And with retrospective reviews, this is probably our biggest area is provider education and documentation. It seems to be common from what I've heard. We struggle with it. We do the best that we can. We like Michelle mentioned, we have our clinical documentation program. We have tools with our child program to flag providers and give them feedback on their documentation and how they're doing. And a lot of our employed physicians are engaged with that, and they do want to know how they're doing and what we think of, you know, what they're presenting to us. But there are a lot of physicians that just don't care. They're not engaged. They're there to do one thing, and we want to change that mentality. We want them to understand the value of risk adjustment. And helping us would help them because we would bother them less. So hopefully that'll happen one day. We want to eventually get an actual in-house medical record retrieval department. We spend hundreds of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars on record retrieval, and it's worth it, but it's a lot of work. And not to mention, our department is not the only department retrieving records. And I can't tell you how many times I've called offices to get records, and they're already mad at me because they just heard from someone from Health First the week prior. They don't want to hear from me 5 times. They don't care if you're different departments. It's all the same to them. So to streamline it internally would make it easier for the providers. It would decrease provider fatigue. It would increase employee fatigue because we could give it, you know, to someone who can consolidate all the requests, get it in a form that makes sense to us and to the providers, and then we can house all of our records. We have those records on site, so we can go to that first before we have to reach outside our walls. So we see that, and we've been talking about that at least since I started about 2.5 years ago. I feel like the conversations are getting more frequent, so I'm really hopeful that that's a good sign, but we'll see. Another big opportunity we have a lot of, and this goes in line with the medical record retrieval, we have a lot of large groups of non-employed physicians that are very costly to get their records, and it's very time-consuming. So they have centralized EMR systems, so if we could get access to that, Obviously, there's a lot of legal stipulations, a lot of things we would have to do to get that in order, but we've gotten it for a few offices already, smaller offices, so we're hopeful that we can get those large groups as well and eliminate a lot of work for a lot of people. And then, of course, we really like the idea of an NLP. We've used one, which I'll talk about in a minute, and we want to continue to move in that direction with the demands that are kind of put on us just with our increase in membership and our productivity that's expected of us. It just makes sense. It's a good way that we can increase our productivity, keep up with the demand, while still maintaining the quality that we have to keep up with. So we had an external review, as Michelle mentioned, with Healthscapes. They came in and evaluated our program just to see how we were doing. And they took all of our data from 2014 to, I believe, like October of 2016. They put it into their analytics, and they gave us results. And overall, like Michelle mentioned, they said we were doing pretty well. They said we were kind of in the leaders of the industry with our chart program and our chart review. There wasn't any one big thing that we were missing. There wasn't any low-lying fruit. It was all kind of minute things, a lot of stuff we knew already that we needed to work on. One of them, of course, being provider education, collaboration. They gave us some really good ideas on how to present feedback to the providers in a way that they would receive it well and actually want to do something with it. So we're working on that now and kind of internalizing that so we can move forward and really get providers engaged. I think that's the most important thing right now. And they did bring up a very valid point that until providers really kind of have skin in the game, it's going to be hard for them to want to do a whole lot. So that's, you know, future talk as well, what we want to do. They did encourage some different use of pharmacy data or different suspecting logics that we haven't used before. So we're considering those moving forward as well. So looking to the future, I mentioned we did use an NLP this past project year, and it didn't go as expected. We used the NLP as a platform for our non-employed physicians, and as Michelle said, a lot of our non-employed physicians are very old school. Their records are not the cleanest. A lot of them are handwritten. It was very difficult to get it to work efficiently for us. It really honestly slowed us down from what we were used to. So we kind of had to switch gears. We still believe in the NLP technology, and we think that it's still going to be extremely beneficial moving forward. We're just going to take a different approach. So we are in talks to try again, do a second kind of pilot program, but this time we're going to integrate it with the EMR systems that we have access to. And we've heard good things going that route, so we're very hopeful for that. Thank
you. Rachel, did you build your natural language processing technology in-house? If you did not, who do you vendor with, and at what point do you apply it? Is this before the coders do the abstraction, after, or at some other point in time?
We did not do it in-house. We did vend it out. We used Health Fidelity this last year. And Michelle could probably talk a bit more about how, because I wasn't on the calls, so I don't know exactly how the NLP worked. If you do, feel free to interject. But we did not do it in-house. No, we will be outsourcing it.
We had to change a lot of how their workflows worked. They built it very specific for Presbyterian. It was very specific to their workflow models. They code one HCC once a year. They don't care about, which is just a different model. We want to validate everything on claims, so it lowers our audit mitigation, so we don't have to do as much back-end audits. So we had to retrain them. We code every diagnosis every 6 months just to make sure with the timing of how the HCC flows and what deadline you're working. We want the money sooner. So we do a six-month reevaluation of every HCC. So that was a lot of change that we did overcome with Health Fidelity. But again, we were using non-EMR, so a lot of them couldn't go through their OCR. Regardless if they came out as an EMR, they really had time parsing the medical records. eClinical Works is a great example if you guys know the EMR. They have a column with their PMH, their meds. They are only really able to read records from our experience that are not directly extracted from an EMR when they're very sentence-driven. You have a SOAP note in an EMR instance. They did well. But they were all, we were also rejecting more diagnoses that we were accepting, which is okay. But I didn't feel like that worked as an NLP. We weren't teaching the system anything. It was more a text to find. It would highlight a diagnosis, but it wasn't learning the behavior. So we took a different route. I think it, had we implemented with the EMR, we may have different results. But we're also looking to streamline processes. So we talked to another vendor, Talix, who was able to provide us data, more data-driven. So we would take that. They're taking in our claims data. We're able to, it's actually teaching the program that in this instance, we're not going to show it to you after X amount of times. You can define your workflows for your coders. And then everything that you reject because it doesn't meet clinical documentation requires, we're going to shoot that out to a provider scorecard so that they can correct that. And that also interfaces with their EMR, so it's at point of service instead of retrospective. So that's where we're kind of just shifting our gear. We don't know what's right or wrong right now. We've just taken two approaches, and we're doing kind of getting in case studies, seeing the ROI. It definitely was fruitful, the last project, but a lot of our SLAs were not met. We were supposed to finish the project in October, and we went through January 22nd, which kind of cut it close. Thank God that EDS changed their deadline, because I wouldn't have been able to map that all back to tie to an EDS claim. It would have been really hard. I could have, but it would have been very hard. So Talix also offers that capability so that they're getting that data out and also doing that EDS mapping for the supplemental data out so that we can get that back.
Okay, when you were doing the new native processing language, what like issues and how did you solve them with your large group physician practices? Because we're looking at that right now, and the obstacle we're trying to overcome is getting, you know, permission to go in and, you know, have them scan down through all their medical charts, and we're getting all the questions back. How do we know they're only going to look at SumaCare charts and not everybody else's? And how can you assure this? So, I mean, we're just in the early stages of our conversation, so I don't know how you guys overcame a lot of that. Do you offer financial incentives or?
So we're in the, so phase one or pilot one, we actually did the chart retrieval and handed it off as a PDF. So they only got the members that we gave them. For pilot two and future, how we're looking in the future, they're looking, and we're in discussion right now with our executive team. So we're just internally. But they would take a CCD and a CCDA. So you're basically saying, here's our members at Health First Health Plan. We're only going to look for these medical record numbers in the system. So that's all that's going to be extracted out on that CCDA or CCD file, and it interfaces based on whatever threshold you want. So do you want a daily fee? Do you want weekly, monthly, however? But the IT, it's IT to IT, but it's based on data file specs. So you have to have very clear and good mapping to be able to crosswalk a medical record number, which a health plan doesn't have, to a HICN or a member ID that the medical group may or may not have. And if they do have it, is it really the correct number? Do they have the right insurance registered? So those are some of the challenges that we've identified and we know, but we just haven't walked through those.
Did those physician groups come back and ask for any type of audit after the fact to say, show us a report of what was extracted, or show us, you know, some type of proof that you really didn't? Because I know, you know, and this is with our sister company, they're raising every one of these issues and red flags, and we're trying to overcome them now. So
we're not even in those talks yet. So that we're literally at Health Plan, at Health First and Florida Hospital, we're proposing, we're at the proposal phase of this is what we're going to do, but the cost saving alone kind of speaks for itself. And there's a lot of measures in those mapping tools and your data that you have to get right that eliminates it. And really, the medical group, you built that SSIS package back on the back end, and it's a data feed. It's not going to pull a member that is not identified as your member if your data is correct on the front end.
So I just went through this because we've just signed actually with Health Fidelity for the Health Fidelity tool and went through many of the challenges that you're articulating. And ironically, the most pushback was from our parent system, right? So my and I can certainly talk to you offline, but my recommendation was I started the conversations early and often, getting to the right people, having the Health Fidelity sort of IT security people on the phone to walk the physician, IT security, the EMR people through step by step. This is what the process looks like. This is how we do the mapping. This is how we ensure security. They provided all of their SOC audit results, which were very comprehensive and very well done. So I think that helped. So before we even signed the contract with Health Fidelity, we had those conversations with the provider groups that we were going to do to ensure that we could get the buy-in up front. And then we just set the expectation that there are going to be audit reports that are going to be generated to say, after they go and they run the NLP and they do what they call ACE, which is the extraction, they're going to give us a report to say, this is who we pulled, this is how many records failed, so that we could provide that back to the providers before they even ask for it, just to offer up, this is the audit trail of who was touched, and that they didn't pull anybody they weren't supposed to.
Yeah, so we're actually looking at it from a project. I've always implemented every data, and we've always integrated every vendor relationship, or implemented, not integrated, internally. This time I'm seeking a project manager, so we've looked at our PM team downstairs so that they can really get all the right players, because we don't have the bandwidth to kind of manage what we know we're getting into with this. We will be on the team and leading it, but I'm going to let a project manager kind of manage all that, because that's what their sole job is.
So I have a question.
Okay. So I have a question. Go back to when you had said the 4 diagnosis codes on your claims. Is that because of the limitation in Amisys? Because we're also on Amisys, or
no.
What's
no,
that?
That's from our employed physicians EMR system. They bill directly from there, and it only allows for 4.
And that only allows
yeah.
the 4.
Are you,
we do 100% chart review on yeah. every one of those members. And
okay,
that's our
so
roadmap.
You do chart review right. to get the extra DX codes.
We don't want them touching our diagnosis. They're yeah. horrible coders.
Okay.
They
I
don't,
was just thinking,
we don't, it actually is, helps us with a risk mitigate. Well, kind of. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
They're horrible coders. They don't really employ certified coders. The physician work flow process is the EMR pops up, and you assign your level, your E&M, and your diagnosis before you're even in that EMR right. assessing and really doing your note. So,
before the note.
Yeah. That's their workflow with the centricity upgrade.
Well, I was just
going to
say, like, we do work with our provider groups. We call it truncation. So mm-hmm. it's just a fancy word for what the system's doing. It's probably an industry term, not something we came up with. But we do supplemental files from our large groups so that we can get whatever their system is truncating, we can get all of those DXs from them.
Yeah, our medical groups are not coders, and we don't want that data.
Yeah.
That data puts us at too high of a risk. So we just we do it supplementally and do those chart reviews on the back end.
Okay, I apologize. I'm not a claims person, but I remember originally, I think on HCFA 1500, it was limited to 4 via EDI, but I thought they had increased it to like 10 now.
12,
thank you.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, so you should be able to get more in, because we also have Amisys, and it's not a limitation of the Amisys. It was the limitation of the EDI. And what we have found at least in my group, is I've created a process where I go out and data mine through the claims looking for the procedure codes and find those and bring them into the database and create a front-end access for our certified coders. Then they go in for the charts that they have EMR access to, and they go in and look at those, and we data mine them to get all the additional diagnoses, because even though we work with our sister companies and the others, they only put one diagnosis yeah. on nerves, because that's all they need to get paid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're coding for the chief complaint and not for...
I'd like to talk about the technical aspects of reporting. I believe very strongly that risk adjustment demands a myriad of reports. You need to track what is your ROI. You need to track what is the percent uptake of your members for, like, in-home assessments. You need to track, you know, how many physicians are we doing coding education on? Can we measure the impact of that coding education? The list just goes on and on and on. And if I'm Lindsay and I'm Laura, I'm looking for a slew of reports consistently that give me good metrics on these things to help me know where the problems are that need to be solved and where we're doing things well. For that reporting, is it the two of you that are doing that, or are there others? And what kind of architecture do you use? I've been working with our IT department to help them understand that because we use SQL Server, we need data space. Right now we're limited to 10 gigabytes, and I'm trying to help them understand that that's not acceptable. So I wondered if you could talk about how you do that data reporting. And do you have, like, a DBA that you work with to help maintain a server so that you can do all the data crunching needed just to make simple reports?
Funny you say that. So we have a new manager of IT that is a data integrator. He's a department integrator. We have never, until RapidM came around and WinRAR, been able to ever even get space on our server. We finally got those tables loaded 2 weeks ago into SQL, so now I can go in and query. What they're only giving access, if you're not a developer right now, is you have temporary tables. So I still have zero space. So we use a lot of SQL. I'm sorry, Access databases. I get data out of SQL. I can use temporary tables, but it makes no sense if it's gone tomorrow. So I save my code. I'm not rewriting my code every day, but we do query out and then dump into SQL. So most of our reports are pretty easily replicated month over month, and all those metrics are being reported on a month to month. Verisend also has very extensive data dumps that they give us and access to reports. So we utilize those tools as well, getting the data out so that monitors our productivity, our chart review, our HCCs, our financials. We're able to take that data and roll it up for an executive presentation. But unfortunately, we're just not at a place where they're going to give us space on SQL yet. But I know it is the vision of our new manager of IT to get that, and I believe we're going to get a risk adjustment. Actuary just got one, and I believe risk adjustment is on the docket for impending space. I'm not sure of the size, though.
Yeah, what we actually did at SumaCare is we have our own file server because IT just gave up on us because we had too many demands. And like I said, my folks are all ex-IT, so we built our own SQL database, and we're doing a lot of this tracking, and then we use Access as a front end into those SQL tables for our coders and to create the different reports to show our finance people. So it's worked out real well for us, but if you could get the space, and like you said, your new IT manager is an innovator, I think you could really pull off a lot of great things that would, you know, really benefit the whole company. It could be a win-win for everybody.
Exactly. I agree.
Michelle, how many more slides you got there?
I don't think
there's one more.
Sweet.
Yep.
Good.
That's good. Right. Not important.
Okay. We thought we would only be up here 15 minutes, so I'm kind of shocked.
Okay, so we don't have the ability to call reporting either. We have to wait the 5 to 10 days. We'll put a request in, and then we're just kind of at the mercy of our IMA team. So I think that would be something also good to include if we're going to be collaborating with folks on calls, because it is crucial. And even though I'm not that kind of coder, I think that Jaretta, with her background in data, could maybe step in and help us there with that for our needs, because I'm always going to her saying, hey, I need my benchmarks. I need this. Give me this. And she's like, well, I'm just still waiting on them. So there's definitely in our integrated system, because they just transferred to being owned by the hospital. So now their leadership train is up through hospital reporting, which is another beast in its own compared to health plan reporting. So Rick, where you may struggle, with coding, we struggle with data.